1363 and Me. It's a podcast from the staff to the people of the Bronx Center of Science and Mathematics. Who am I? Well, I'm Nikhil Krishna. I got two people with me today. Last episode was just one. Who are these two people we got today?
So, Mr. Palacios, but we do have one other person with us today. I think it's Friday for you, brother. So we do have one other. We have a guest with us today. We're going to allow her to introduce herself and kind of talk a little bit about her role at BCSM. And then, so who are you?
Hi, everyone. 1363 and Me. I'm Laverne Paris. I teach living environment, but my passion is racial and social justice. And I'm really thankful to be here.
So, y'all, the first segment that we have on, we didn't really get through on the first episode, but the first segment is called the entry ticket. And so this is a space where we are going to kind of unload how we're feeling, what we're basically the energy that we're bringing into this space, and what's on our mind. So that way we can kind of unload that, unpack that, and get that out before we kind of have a conversation with each other. So something that's been all kind of like modeled and kind of open up, something that's been on my mind today, actually, before kind of even coming into this kind of conversation is just what this year is going to mean for me. And in terms of, I've been thinking a lot about like how I'm feeling kind of very uncertain right now, but I'm also kind of feeling uplifted because I see there's so much opportunity for risk taking this year in terms of like empowering my students and professional growth. And I feel like there's, despite all the uncertainty and all the kind of fear almost and just craziness happening, there's just a huge opportunity for me to really rethink what I do with students. And it's just a really big opportunity that I don't want to miss and I don't want to pass up. So I was thinking about that today. I was having a conversation with some folks earlier in my department, and it really made me think of that. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. Chris, where are you at, man? How are you feeling? How's everything?
I'm just chilling. I had a great lunch, which is, you know, good for me. And then I'm actually, you know, I'm kind of nervous because I get this Celtics game at 9 o'clock tonight. It's game 7. Oh my God. I've been like going online to see who's favorite. Celtics are favored by like 2 points. So, you know, probabilities, man, probabilities.
Yeah. Good stuff. Paris, how are you feeling, man? How's everything?
I'm feeling very contemplative and reflective and hopeful because of a conversation we had in our RSJ committee. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you about that. We were discussing what to put on a slide, and I was encouraging us to use the term white supremacy because we can't talk about racial justice without talking about white supremacy. And the discussion got very emotional. Huh. And that's good because then it forced me to step back and say, well, how can I present my argument in a way that embraces everyone so they can understand we need to talk about this painful topic? It's a painful topic because no one wants to feel less than, and no one wants to really, it's difficult to acknowledge that there is an ideology that purports that people are inferior to others, but we have to talk about that. So when I had a moment to step back, I said, you know, thank you for hearing me, but what I really want to say now that I'm calmer is that we cannot talk about racial justice without talking about white supremacy. It's as if we were talking about, it's like talking about the weather without mentioning rain. I said, the tools that we need to give our colleagues are really that to for them to say that I'm not a white supremacist, I don't support white supremacy, but it exists. And that as a teacher, as a white teacher, I see you as a human being. I see you in your humanity, and I'm going to treat you with dignity. And I see that you can accomplish and fulfill your goals. And that this is a painful topic to talk about. It's extremely painful. And that's why the responses were so emotional. But, you know, I also emphasized how much faith I have in our staff. And I don't just mean the teachers, I mean all the staff and our students to understand and to be able to think critically about white supremacy in the way where they can separate a white supremacist ideology from a teacher who is white. So it forced me, and I'm thankful for it, it forced me to really remember what the mission is. The mission is, right? The mission is fighting this and how to get everyone to the fight, really, to bring everyone to this fight. And that means we're going to be uncomfortable, we're going to be hurt, but if we've made mistakes in the past, acknowledge them, you know, and say, you know, perhaps I spoke to you in a certain way that could be interpreted like this, or maybe I felt this way about you and your people, but I was wrong. But to come from a place of humility and willingness to grow. So, you know, that conversation was so important because, you know, at first when I mentioned it, people were resistive, and then I said, okay, you know what, forget it. I'm tired. I can't, you know, I can't deal. I'm so tired of having the same discussion, right? But Mr. DeVoe, thank you, Brother DeVoe, he said, no, Ms. Parris, come on, Ms. Parris, don't back down, because he loves it when I start fighting, right? So I said, okay. I said, look, this is the way it has to be. I said, you know, I'm not imposing anything on anyone, but it has to be said, because look at the world our students are inheriting. Look at this world where global racial violence is on the rise. You know, it is frightening, but it's real. And I give our students the credit because I know how strong they are. And I feel that no matter where they are on this journey, they have the strength to handle it. Yeah. And we can give them the resources and the tools, but we have to talk about it. So that's how I'm feeling. Like, it's not about my pride or my ego. It's not about me being right. It's about this mission and preparing our students and our colleagues.
I appreciate you bringing that in. And I could tell that that was a really important moment for you. And I can, you know, I've known you for a little while, not that long, but so I appreciate you kind of unpacking that a little bit for us and for yourself. And that's really a big part of this podcast too, I think, is to give a space for us to reflect on experiences we have and to be heard. So I really appreciate you, you know, really taking that to another level. And we're going to talk more about that a little bit later, I hope. So to kind of start us off, I would love to, you know, get into the sort of meat and potatoes of the conversation. And so I would love for us to kind of, you know, for you to introduce yourself a little bit more and tell us more about it. We know that you obviously your name, you teach living environment, and you're really passionate about racial justice and social justice. But tell everyone a little bit about you and your journey and your story. Like, how did you get into teaching? Like, how did you end up here? Tell us a little bit more about that.
You know, my journey or my path towards teaching was, well, I have two forays into teaching. The first time I taught was in the 90s, when you didn't need a master's, you could teach with a provisional license. Wow. And that's when I taught middle school. And I taught actually in Brooklyn, in Fort Greene, at Junior High School 113, Ronald Edmonds Learning Center. It was the junior high school that Spike Lee went to. Oh. That's an aside. Yeah, I taught there. And then I left teaching and eventually came back after a couple different periods in grad school. And when I came back to teaching the second time, it was really because I have a brother with special needs, and I wanted to be able to reach all my students, because my brother is my inspiration on so many levels. And I wanted students to see that all kinds of education, all forms of education, are accessible. It doesn't matter where you are, what you understand, or what you think you understand, just that everyone can learn something. So when I came to teaching the second time, I really just enjoyed being able to connect with young people and open their minds. And what brought me to BCSM was I left a school in Bushwick. Shout out to BSSJ.
I taught in Brooklyn for many years, so we probably in the same spot. We didn't even know it.
Where were you?
I was in Bed-Stuy and Bushwick, like right on the foot of there.
Oh my God. I used to live in Bed-Stuy.
So we were probably neighbors and didn't even know it. School neighbors.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, so I loved it, but it was time. You know, I had taught there for 6 years, and it was great because I created my own curriculum. I was teaching bioethics as well as environmental justice, but you know, I felt like I needed to be closer to home because of my caregiving responsibilities. So I left and I taught at a school in Queens for 2 years, which was an experience. And then because I knew I was moving to Mount Vernon, I decided to look in the Bronx, and I came to BCSM, and I just felt such, I felt a connection to you, Mr. Krishna. I met you my first day. That's right. During my demo lesson. Yes.
Like, what is it? Room 101 or something like that?
That's right.
You're invaded. And I think the kids were already, you know, they were already like, okay, I'm into this. I'm into this. So that was like my first interaction with his parents.
Yeah. He was amazing. He was so supportive. And just from that, I felt very welcomed. And also it's a homecoming for me because I grew up in the Bronx. I went to community school 211, which is right across the highway down by Persona Park. And it's a bilingual school. And so coming back to the Bronx meant a lot to me. I spent my formative years here. My happiest years in my childhood were in the Bronx, East 172nd Street.
This is a homecoming for you. This is a homecoming.
Exactly. Exactly. And it meant so much to me to come back to the Bronx. So BCSM, special place with really extraordinary people. That's what I'm feeling.
Yeah, I guess to that point, one thing that I was curious about was, you know, well, let's flash back to like last year, we first met fall of 2019, literally like over a year ago we met, you know?
And yeah.
Flash back then, and then here we are in fall of 2020, or almost fall of 2020.
Wow.
What do you think is different about you, your approach, your role? Tell me more about that.
That's a great question. I feel so much more myself now than when I first came. I think when I first arrived at BCSM, I was trying to do things a certain way that didn't ring true within myself. And I say that because part of the process for me with growth is trying different things and analyzing how I respond when I'm doing those things. So I tried to use tools that weren't my own, but they didn't ring true with me, right? So I had no connection with them because I didn't create them. And I know some people can use other people's resources and, you know, borrow and use whatever, and that's fine. But for myself, in order for me to process information, I have to create it. I have to decide how I want to approach it. And I need the background to understand, okay, what is it that I want to get across, instead of me trying to figure out, well, what was this teacher trying to do? Right. So that for me was, that was a challenge, but a worthwhile challenge, because it made me accept how I work, you know, and really focus on my vision for a class, because I had that luxury, and I say it's a luxury because not everyone gets to teach an elective. You know, teaching a Regents class is so much more regimented in the sense that there's a certain amount of material a teacher needs to cover in order to prepare their students for the Regents. So when I taught my elective in Bushwick for 6 years, I did. I literally had the luxury of creating my own curricula, two different curricula, creating my own performance tasks, everything that went with it, and delving into it with such passion because it was something that I truly cared about, and something that combined the disciplines that I focused on in school, like I was able to focus on bioethics, which merged my love of biology, science, policy, and the law, because after one of my grad school experiences was law school, and bioethics was the only course that kept me in law school. And I say that because I was miserable, but that misery was valuable because it made me appreciate my other grad school experience, which was at Tufts, where I studied environmental science and management. And it was there were two completely different types of education, whereas graduate school for environmental science, the professors encouraged conversation, dialogue, group work, challenging specific notions, and collaboration. Law school is very cut and dry. Memorize the rule, state the issue, analyze, and, you know, spit it back on the paper. That's it.
So it seems to me like, you know, your experiences during your first year, which was last year, here kind of helped you look inward and kind of understand, because the curriculum you were using wasn't kind of like yours per se, like, you know, you were just getting started, so you had to work from something. So, but it really made you realize what you wanted living environment to look and feel like, and what you want your class to look like. So it almost like it took you back to your Bushwick years of, you know, whenever you were using your curriculum and kind of like to relive that kind of experience of what, you know, reimagining what this course could be, what my classroom could be. So yeah, that's super interesting. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Because now my approach to living environment is completely different. And, you know, the relationship that a teacher has with their co-teacher can be so pivotal.
Yeah.
And I say that because when working or collaborating with someone, and there's a certain amount of openness, I believe, is necessary. And openness to ideas, openness to accepting people for who they are, and openness to whatever you're willing to create for the students. You know what I mean? So having that, you know, I was able to now approach living environment in a completely different way. And that's so much more fulfilling for me because these were the concepts and ideas that I had in mind initially when I started at BCSM, but I'm now putting into place and actually enjoying it and having fun creating tools for the students. So that's so satisfying, having that freedom.
Cool.
Yeah, and just to kind of spring on the idea of, you know, finding the best approach for you, right? The best thing that maximizes yourself, the best thing that maximizes, you know, what your students are getting out of the class, all those things. I'm gonna say a statement and I want you to take a stance. You can say that you completely agree, you can say you completely disagree, or you can say that you're mixed. You got a little bit of both.
And you gotta tell us why.
Yeah, you gotta tell us. Of course, right? It's like school, you have to say why. But
we ain't playing no here, Pop. We ain't playing Miss Paris.
The statement is this.
I know you're not.
What's that?
No, I know you're not playing.
The statement is, modern is always better. What's your reaction to that statement?
Mixed. Extremely mixed. Because, well, for two reasons. Because always is such an extreme, you know, qualifier, right? Always better. There are certain things about modernity that are amazing. And there are certain things that we lose because of it. I mean, I can think about just the simple use of a cell phone. I mean, when I was growing up, no such thing until like sometime in the late 90s when they looked like when they looked like shoes. And they were so huge. They looked like big old shoes. Oh my God, right? And so just something like that. And for social purposes, like when we were going out, back in the day, we would have to leave messages on people's machines. There was that excitement, you know, like, oh, I have a message. You know, we're supposed to hit up this spot. I don't know. All the plans might have changed. And so there was an excitement, an anticipation for having to wait. And now with cell phones, everything's so immediate. You can reach everyone immediately. You can get information immediately. Like, even Google, just Google. I remember doing research at the library at the, using the, you know, the, what is it? The Dewey Decimal System, you know, looking up books and just being able to research, right? I remember that, the card catalog, that's it. I remember using the card catalog to find, to get information. And that process of uncovering and unearthing valuable information that no one can find was so rewarding. Mm-hmm. So rewarding. It felt like, because that's what it was literally when you had to go through the stacks and look through books or microfilm or things like that. There was that feeling of, I did it, you know? And now all I have to do is type something in the search bar, and it's there.
You know? I hear you, what I hear you saying is like process over product. Like, you valued going down this pathway, trying to that's not it. And then going down this, you know, so the process over the product probably, I don't know, but I hear you.
Exactly. Exactly. And then also too, with technology, there's, you know, the cyberbullying, that's the negative, but the positives are how people have used, you know, Facebook and YouTube to put a, to shine a light on the racial violence. I feel like that's so positive. You know, we're putting people on blast. You know, a lot of things would not have happened without the social media. So in terms of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, I mean, for that, technology has been phenomenal.
For sure. Really, so I mean, I think that's a perfect segue. I think, you know, we kind of want to return to what you were talking about earlier in terms of the ongoing like social uprising and social justice and racial justice and Black Lives Matter movement, that is really, you know, as the school year begins, like really, really just something that our nation and certainly our school community and just people in general are thinking a lot about. So, you know, tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on it, and just, you know, ripple effects you see happening in schools in general across our country, and also just, you know, what advice do you have for teachers?
That's, I feel like that's such a timely question, and it's so loaded, and I'm so glad you asked it, because in this time, at this juncture of history, I feel the revolution is now. The revolution is now. And I say that with the hope and the expectation that the righteous, notice I didn't say perfect, the righteous are rising up, you know, to fight against white supremacy. That's what Black Lives Matter is about. All lives cannot matter until Black lives matter. So whenever people counter all lives matter, that's a fallacy. It's just a fallacy in this country. This country was born out of bloodshed, torture, dehumanization of every ethnic group, right? So the myth of America is also something that needs to be dismantled. And to have these conversations is key. Key to have these conversations. So when you ask about the ripple effects at BCSM, I remember the town hall. And specifically, I always point, because he said in, during the town hall, we never learn our history. We need to learn our history. And he's exactly right, because that's one of the main effects or main negative effects of white supremacy, the erasure of the history of Black and Indigenous people of color and our contributions to the classical world and to the modern world. You know, that lack of information and the fact that our educational system supports that and the Regent supports that. So many structures within the educational system unknowingly or uncaringly support that part of white supremacy where other cultures are not highlighted. I mean, our curricula is completely Eurocentric. There are certain mentions and chapters of certain ancient kingdoms, but the connections are not made to the modern world. The connections are not made so strongly that we can say, this is my history. So for students to be crying out for history and for an understanding of their ancestors, it's so powerful. And I feel that our young people are the ones who are going to take up the charge. I mean, we're all part of this, but let's face it, it's their world, right? They're going to be inheriting what's happening, what's left in the wake. So
schools, you know, and the schools play a critical role because we're educating these kids, right? So I mean, as a white male, you know, certainly, I mean, I have a lot of learning and a lot of re-education to do myself. And I also feel responsible for helping students in whatever capacity I can, helping them learn their history. Because I think oftentimes students step into learning spaces and they're just not aware of our country's history, like whole entire history, like not just the oppressor's point of view. So certainly as a teacher, as a school, as an institution, we play an incredibly important role in this work. So can you talk a little bit about what you're doing as a teacher, as a member of our staff, as a Black woman, like what is your role? What are you doing to in this movement at this time?
Thank you for that question. That's really thoughtful. Well, one of the things we did this summer was our racial and social justice working group that you were a part of. And it was phenomenal on multiple levels because we had the opportunity to learn from each other, but also to really learn about ourselves and address issues that we've been dealing with and how we want to approach teaching and preparing our students so that they can be strong in this world. So one of the courses that I'll be teaching is a racial and social justice elective. And your question you asked about teachers, I think one of the things we can do at BCSM is to make teachers and help teachers by providing them with the resources become comfortable talking about white supremacy. And by teachers acknowledging, saying, look, not every white person is a white supremacist. It's a painful ideology to talk about, but we have to talk about this because we wouldn't be here in this moment if white supremacy weren't a reality. You know, we would never have had the movements, the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, the women's movement, the disability rights movement. We wouldn't have had any of those movements had white supremacy not existed. So when we talk about white supremacy, it's important that we emphasize to our students that it is an ideology. It is based on pseudoscience, you know, scientific racism, which created a hierarchy of the races for specific reasons, such as colonialism, genocide, chattel slavery. But the fact that these institutional structures for racism still exist means that they were never effectively, of course, dismantled because of what? Economics, capitalism, and oppression, control. So the thing about racism that I feel we all need to understand, and I have to keep reminding myself, is that it is so complex, multifaceted, layered, and it affects all of us. So we're all being hurt by white supremacy. The fact that people want to learn about other cultures' history and contributions means that there's something lacking in our educational system. You know, so not having that knowledge hurts us all. Not being able to see people in their totality as human beings hurts us all. You know, the fact that it is painful to talk about, and especially, you know, for some white people, means that it needs to be spoken about because we've all suffered, whether we have guilt or whether we have pain from guilt or pain from being the victims of it or having suffered at the hands of it, rather, because I don't like to use the victim terminology, but we have all suffered from white supremacy. So I really want to urge people to use the term and to clarify what it means and to accept whatever mistakes they've made, we have made, and say, look, this is what I did. It was wrong. But moving forward, let's talk about how hurtful it can be what we can do as a community to dismantle it, you know? And it's an ongoing process. It's not one and done. It's an ongoing process.
I guess one thing that's kind of a follow-up I had to that was, if you were to say, what would your ideal policy change be to, you know, it could be in response to the horrific brutality, the horrific police brutality that you've seen. There's so many different layers to this, but what is, I guess, one policy change that you think needs to happen?
Oh, I feel across the board, schools and in every nation need to teach racial and social justice as a core class, not as an elective, as a core class. And when you teach it as a core class, you can teach, there are so many topics within that, because as an elective, it doesn't give you enough time, because within racial and social justice, you have the history of ancient civilizations, you have the contributions of ancient civilizations, you also have, you have the intellectuals presented in every culture, you know, the philosophers, the scientists, the geologists, everyone, right? And then you also have within that the radical thinkers, the people involved, the political leaders and intellectual leaders involved in social upheaval and change, and the different figures who've been demonized throughout history when all they were fighting for was human rights. And of course, I'm going to talk about Malcolm. He's my hero. Malcolm X is said everything that everyone is saying now, and yet people are so averse to reading about him, to embracing him, to learning about him. So I say his name because it needs to be said. You know, I say all their names: Marcus Garvey, Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, Ida B. Wells, Harriet Tubman, Nat Turner, Toussaint Louverture. I can go on and on, but really, it's our ancestors who we're learning from. I feel like we, the teachers, as facilitators, need to present the ancestors for who they are, because we are facilitators. We are presenting information that they wrote about, that they discussed, that information and work that they labored over and died for. They died for us. So I feel that that has to happen across the board. It has to be a core class. It needs to be taught.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that, you know, and something I've been thinking about today, we're going to pivot into our last segment, but one thing I've been thinking about in terms of curriculum is just kind of like what you mentioned, and how colorblind, especially standardized curriculum, is just, it's a colorblind curriculum. You know, it's very kind of like, quote unquote, race neutral. And in that way, it kind of perpetuates racial injustice and racism. And so certainly as a math teacher, you know, troubling the curriculum and asking these sort of racialized questions about it is a way, I think, it also getting at that. But it'd be interesting to see, you know, what policy changes, and if like an African American studies course becomes core curriculum and something that students need to graduate. I think that's an incredible idea and a great idea. So we're going to pivot now. We appreciate all your thoughts. We're going to pivot now to our closing segment.
Yes.
And so our last segment of every episode is called The Last Call for Lunch. And so it's basically a playoff of who says that at the end of every lunch period. And so I think we're also hoping that lunch gets back to normal at some point. I think we're also just injecting that sort of hopeful energy that we all get back to some sort of normalcy. And so in the spirit of De La Rosa, we want to kind of, you know, we've named this segment in his honor. So that's, you know, the idea behind this segment is we turn to the title of this podcast, which is 1363 and Me. And so we want to kind of, you know, throw that to you, Ms. Paris, and kind of basically ask you to interpret that statement. Think about maybe, you know, what does it mean to be part of the BCSM community? Maybe that includes something that BCSM should know about you, your relationship with the school, things like that. So we're going to give you the floor and give you an opportunity to kind of reflect on the statement 1363 and Me.
Wow. I like that. That's a great opportunity for me to think. And I feel like for me, 1363 in me means growth. Hmm. Growth. And growth is painful, but it can also be joyful. And I say that in the context of what I'm about, the mission, freedom, right? I'm so thankful to have this opportunity. I've grown so much this year, being pushed, you know, learning the remote teaching, and then doing the RSJ working group, and now with the committee. I feel like I have the opportunity to work with some extraordinary people. And with that said, that people who are pushing me to grow and bringing out better in me and forcing me to think about and really reevaluate and constantly question myself on the best way to reach that mission and to keep going further with the mission of racial justice. So it's been and continues to be a really amazing journey.
Yeah, I mean, I respect you saying that. And as someone has gotten to know you a lot better, even over the last, like, you know, 6 to 7 months, you saying that you've been inspired by others, how you've grown as a result of your relationship with the school and with other teachers and staff members. I can speak for so many staff members, including myself, obviously, that have been touched by you and your passion and your knowledge and your willingness to and, you know, have been really moved by you and changed by you. And it really is, I think the BCSM community is very, very, very fortunate and lucky and blessed to have you with us right now in this moment, because we need you. And we really need you. And we're just so thankful that you're so willing and open to share with us and grow with us. And so, while you're being inspired by us, it's tenfold on the other end. So thank you, Ms. Paris, for being with us. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm tears are welling up. I can't thank you enough. Thank you. I'm humbled. Thank you.
Yeah. No, well, thank you, to be honest. You know, it's like I said, I think one of the things that I appreciate, you know, it might be, you would just randomly pop in, you know, 3:27 on a Friday, and I'd be like, you know, bring my homework and stuff, and you'd be like, hey, what's up? And I said, oh, not too much. I said, oh, can I help you with something? And you're just saying, no, I just wanted to say hi. How's it going? So I think that's you, you know, and yeah.
Cool.
You guys are great.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you being on. This is our inaugural episode. And so you really, I think you blew up the spot. You helped us set a good tone. And we appreciate you taking some time out. It's crazy these days, And we just, you know, you stepped up for us. And so we appreciate, we were just humbled to be able to give you this platform to kind of share a little bit, just a little bit of your story. And we're thankful. So thank you so much, Ms. Paris.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, so we'll
see
you.
Guys are the best.
Thanks everyone thank you everyone for listening to 1363 and me.
Exactly.
As for Mr. Palacios and
Mr. Krishna,
we'll see you guys.
Bye. Bye.